I do not have Jared Carabas nor Brandon fucking Walker with me. Jared was going to join me, but unfortunately some scheduling conflict prevented that. So I did the show solo. It wound up going very well regardless. The interview is with longtime WWE ring announcer and really legend of the business, Lillian Garcia. This is a voice iconic to the wrestling business. At this point, she's calling a match. It has a big fight feel. That's just how it goes. It was a pleasure talking to Lillian. We had a great time. Before we get into that, let me remind you about our presenting sponsor, 3Chi, and their Delta 8 THC. What is Delta 8 THC? It is a federally legal version of THC, which has effects that are the perfect hybrid of CBD and Delta 9 THC, which is found in weed, giving it a similar buzz and all the medicinal effects of Delta 9 without the laziness, anxiety, paranoia, or mental fogginess that comes with it. Delta 8 users report feeling far more active and outgoing, with increased confidence and almost none of the anxiousness and paranoia associated with Delta 9 usage. And listen, we're not trashing Delta 9, right? If Delta 9 gets legalized, that's probably good for a Delta 8, I think, across the board. Shout out to Delta 9 in New Jersey for the voters legalizing that. That's just amazing. I'll be returning to my home state of New Jersey in the next few years, without a doubt. So shout out to them. But for now in New York, you need this stuff. Even in Jersey, you need this stuff. You know, it's kind of different feels. Weed, if you want to like really, really get stoned and be kind of drooling over yourself, fine. Delta 8, if you're looking for a smooth high, if you're looking for a little buzz without the laziness, without the anxiety, without the paranoia. It's good stuff, though. You will get high from this. So, you know, be careful, especially with the gummies. If you go to 3G.com right now, you can shop for their Delta 8 vapes, gummies, tinctures, and oils that can be used to make homemade edibles. This stuff is all USA-grown hemp. This is all formulated in the USA by a biochemist. Use the promo code BASEMENT, and you'll receive 5% off at checkout. You must be 21 or older to purchase. This stuff is great stuff. I swear by it. I love the vapes. I love the Incredible Hulk strain. I love the edibles, the black raspberry, I think it is. Oh, so delicious. You got to be careful with those, though, because they're so delicious that you want to eat the whole bag. That would probably be dangerous. I would start with like half a gummy. That's what Clem starts with, and he says that really gets him going. So go to 3chi.com. Again, that's the number 3chi.com right now. Shop for all that stuff. Use the promo code BASEMENT, and you will receive 5% off your order. Go get this stuff right now. All right, let's get into this interview with WWE legend Lillian Garcia. Hello and welcome back to the show, ladies and gentlemen. I am joined by a very special guest, someone that has been around the WWE for a very long time, someone that I'm delighted to be joined by right now. It's Lillian Garcia. Her new podcast, Chasing Glory, well, not her new podcast, but her podcast, Chasing Glory, is now available on the WWE Network and the free version of the WWE Network. I've heard your podcast described as therapy sessions for WWE superstars, Lillian. So start there. And what do you think of makes that happen? Is it the way you approach the podcast? Is it just your personality? Is it that you've been around the WWE? You know the ropes of it a little bit. What do you think that is?
First of all, I want to thank you for having me on. And I want to thank all the listeners that are taking the time right now to listen to this. Yeah, Chasing Glory is a labor of love for me. And, you know, the way that you asked that question is kind of the way that it all started, because 2004, I was sitting in the locker room with these amazing female superstars and we were sharing our stories and some of our struggles. And it just dawned on me right there. And I was like, wow, if people knew your journey, if they knew like what you've been through and then you still got through it and became a superstar, or sometimes even what you're still going through, I was like, I feel like they would learn a lot from it. I think that they would be inspired from it. And I think that they could really identify with you even more. And I even pitched the idea to WWE in 2004, but it was too early then. You know, this was before podcast. There wasn't this platform. So when 2016, when I left WWE, you know, I was sitting with my dad trying to figure out what do I do next as I was taking care of him. And unfortunately, you know, he passed away, but he got to see the show. When I told him about this idea, he loved it. And I launched it in November of 2016. I can't believe here we are 4 years later. But I launched it and he got to watch the show for a solid month before he passed and just really gave his blessing on it. He loved it. And I think it's that same premise of when we were in the locker room, a lot of the girls even told me, they're like, you're like the mother hen. Like they would come to me with these, you know, challenges that they had. And I don't know whether that's like my mom and what she was always there for me to listen to, my dad as well, and would help me out with some, you know, challenges that I might be coming with, even with the bullying that I went through early on in my, you know, when I came from Spain to South Carolina. It was quite the transition. And I think that that allowed me to have empathy for people. And I could see that they were judging me so badly and so, you know, so intensely without even knowing me, that I really made a conscious decision at that moment to not judge people at all. And so that's kind of what I do with the superstars in our conversations is, A, you know, I'm the first one to talk about any challenges that I've been through. I think it's important. If I'm going to ask you to be vulnerable, then I've got to be the first one. And I think through my own experiences and my own challenges, people can learn from it. And so that's what's happened is that superstars have trusted me that this is a show not about, you know, exploiting their stories. It's really about sharing and owning your journey. And from that, you can empower so many people and it becomes more powerful when you own your story.
Absolutely. I love that. And congratulations on the 4-year anniversary of the podcast. That's a huge accomplishment in and of itself. And speaking of your journey, I'd love to talk about you coming over from Spain when you were 8 years old. So you were born in Spain. I read that your father worked for the embassy. Is that true?
Yeah, I was raised there. My dad was stationed in the military. So he worked for the embassy there. And I came over when I was 8 years old.
What was that like growing up in Spain? Or maybe not growing up, but at least the first 8 years of your life growing
loved
up in Spain.
Loved it. Oh my God. It was amazing. Spain, the culture, it was really amazing growing up in that atmosphere. And now we were lucky in the fact that we had to leave. I think it was like every 6 months or something, or every year or something like that. We had to leave for the visa situation and then come back. So even though my dad was in the military, that's kind of crazy, but hey, it's the rules, right? So my parents were like, okay, well, we got to leave. So let's go to Italy this weekend. Let's go to Germany. Or, you know, when you're in Europe, you get to do that, right? So that's what made it so fascinating is not only was I going to Italy, I was going to another whole different culture. I was going to Germany to another whole different culture. So early on, I got to experience different, you know, ethnicities and cultures. And it was incredible.
That's really cool. So you fell in love with it right away. When you came over to America, to South Carolina, like you said, did you not like America right away? Or did you also fall in love with that?
I was so excited to come to the U.S. I had a photo, actually. It was wild. And because I was American, but I'd never stepped foot in America. And so when my parents were like, we're going to America, I was like, oh my God, we're going to America. Now I had a flyer of the Statue of Liberty and she was white. I don't know why. But when I got to the US and came to New York and she's green, I'm like, wait, what? So I was a little shocked there. And when I did come to New York, at that time, New York was not the New York that it is now. And in the fact that it was pretty dirty and Spain was very, very, very clean. So that was a little bit of shock of seeing all the, you know, all the trash on the side of the streets and stuff like it was just, you didn't see that in Spain. So I was a bit shocked when I came over. But then when I went to South Carolina, my dad ended up getting stationed at Fort Jackson. I was excited to go to school. And so for me, I had the perception of different cultures and, you know, I'd already experienced all of that, but I didn't realize that not everybody gets to grow up that way. So for me, when I came from speaking Spanish, from wearing dresses to school, where, you know, everyone's wearing jeans in the US, I immediately got bullied and I didn't understand why. And it wasn't until years later, processing all the stuff, like we talk on Chasing Glory, you know, processing all of that, that I realized, oh, I was just like an outsider. Like people didn't understand my culture. They didn't understand me wearing dresses. And even though I spoke English, just knowing that I spoke Spanish, it was different. And so immediately I stuck out like a sore thumb.
Yeah. And it seems like you've always had these entertainment dreams, right? From a really young age. You wanted to be a singer, you participated in competitions and stuff like that. Do you think that came from getting to experience all these different cultures, especially in Europe where that, you know, music especially is such a huge part of that culture?
Well, I know that for sure. What happened was my dad wanted to learn how to play the guitar, the Spanish guitar. That was just a passion of his. He just always loved that. And I do too. I love the Spanish guitar music.
Yeah.
So he had an instructor that came over to the house to teach him how to play guitar. Well, while he was playing the instructor, not my dad didn't know yet. But while the instructor was playing, all of a sudden my sister and I started singing with him. And the instructor was like, wait a minute. She was like, I was on one side. He was, you know, she's on the other. And he's like, oh my God, you guys sound like amazing. So he would just come over and start playing songs and then put us in these competitions and stuff. My poor dad never learned how to play the guitar because the instructor would never put the guitar down. And that's where the love of music started. I just knew right then and there, this is what I want to do.
So were you able to turn to that and other entertainment dreams when you did get bullied and kind of focus in on your career?
Yeah, that was the one thing that it's funny you should ask that, because when I got bullied, I always sang. And when I sang and I joined the choir and all that, but I always did solos. When I sang, you could hear a pin drop in the room. And what I've processed later is that I kept saying throughout my life, I have to sing, I have to sing, I have to sing, I have to sing. And I put this pressure to always have singing in my life, but it became you're putting pressure, not because you absolutely, I do love it, but it became more than just loving it. It became, oh, I get it. It was the only time that I could actually silence the bullies.
Yeah.
So because it was the only time I could silence the bullies, it became that thing that I really had that stronghold on it. Like I have to keep silencing people. And so singing has got to be everything. And it was through the process of all the work that I have done to unpack all of these things that I realized, oh, no, you don't have to sing to be like, you know, your identity. You just sing because you love it.
Yeah.
So it's different. The weight of it is different.
Yeah. So you continue on your musical career. You're still making music to this day, I believe. But when does the WWE come along? I know, you know, timeline-wise, they come along around late 90s, 99, right?
99, yeah.
How do they come along? Like, how did they discover you? Did you discover them? Do you have any prior knowledge about wrestling when they reached out?
I used to watch WWF at the time when I was a kid. So I was the one with my dad yelling at the TV. I would yell at Ric Flair and oh my God, it's so crazy to know that there I was working with Ric Flair years later and introducing him. Crazy. And my dad got to meet Rick, which was really,
that's
really
awesome.
Very, very special. So yeah, but I fell out of it when I went to college. I fell out of it. I think even in high school, you know, I got really into my studies and was, you know, either studying or on the weekend I was singing with the band. But when I moved to New York is when an agent that I had, he said, hey, there's an audition for the WWF. And I was like, oh, the World Wildlife Fund? He's like, no, World Wrestling Federation. I'm like, wait, what? Like me and wrestling? Right? So I remember almost not going to the audition because I didn't know it was for ring announcer. I was like, I can't wrestle. He goes, no, it's not for wrestling. He goes, I'm not really sure what it's for, but I know it's not wrestling.
Yeah.
It's something to do with broadcasting. So I was like, okay. And then he goes, look, just go to the audition. You never know. Best advice I ever took. And I went to the audition and, you know, there was a callback and then it's a longer story, but the short of it is I end up getting called back and I get, you know, my first day is on Monday Night Raw and my second day is on SmackDown. It's crazy.
Yeah. So what is an audition like? You don't have to tell me the entire long story of the callback, but what was a ring announcer audition like back in the day?
Well, I remember Michael Cole being there and he would interview me and I would then turn around and interview him. So I do remember that was part of it, which is what I ended up doing on SmackDown with those backstage interviews. So that was part of the audition. When they did the callback, they put me in the booth to do commentary, play by play. Oh man, when I tell you how hard that is,
yeah,
that is so hard. Especially if you don't know the storylines, and at that time I didn't know the storylines.
Of course, yeah. Okay?
I don't know the wrestling moves. I don't know the names. So what am I really commentating? Oh, there's a guy. He's jumped over the rope, and oh, he's in green tights, and whoa, watch what he's doing. You know, it sounded so horrible, but I didn't know. So you have to know those things. I just remember putting the headset down, going, that's not what you're going to hire me for. I know. And they never did. So then there was one other thing that they handed me a tape, a black roll of tape. And they said, look, we want you to sell this tape, but you can't sell it as tape. Ready? When you sell it for 1 minute, ready, go. And they give you no time to think. And I looked at the tape and I'm like, ladies and gentlemen, you see this? Oh, this is not what you think. All right, ladies, you're at a party and you forgot your bracelets. All you got to do is, ooh, I'm sitting there putting the tape around my bracelets. I mean, it's like instantly you've got these black bands. It's cool. Oh, and don't stop there. You want to be a little kick-ass? Then just put them up here. You're like Xena the Warrior. Now they're counting me down. They have 30 seconds left. So I was like, all right. And at this party, your pants are falling down. You have no belt. So what do? Oh, you got the solution. Lift up your shirt. You got the tape. Wrap it around you. Put the shirt over it. Seamless. You're all good. Now they're counting me down. I got 10 seconds to go. So I was like, so the next time you look at this roll of tape, don't look at it as just tape because it's so much more. Cut. I just went like, what just happened? Like, where did that just come out of? And the whole place started applauding. And I remember it's because they told me later, they wanted to know, because it's live TV, they want to know how quickly can you think on your feet.
Wow. And it's a great test.
Like, yeah. So what's crazy is I originally auditioned in Spanish because I auditioned for Super Astros, and then come to find out they sent that part of the tape that was me selling the tape was in English. They sent that over to Kevin Dunn, who then called me in for SmackDown.
Wow. What an amazing journey to WWE. So I looked it up. Your first night on the job on Monday Night Raw, it was, let's see, I have it written down here.
Yeah, let's see.
August 23rd, 1999.
Yes.
And it was actually the first night that Triple H won his WWF championship. And yes. I watched the video. You got to call that in the main event. What do you remember about that night? I think it was in Iowa as well.
It was Iowa State University. Yes. I did not know that was the first time he'd won. Again, I had gotten out of wrestling, so I didn't even know what I was walking into. I had Montezuma's Revenge as well, my very first day at the job, because I had just gotten back from the Dominican Republic the day before. So, oh my God, for anybody who doesn't know that is, it's like your intestines are upside down. And then I had a parasite that they found as well. So it was awful. So I just remember the panic of it all, that I couldn't use cue cards that night, that I didn't know whose name was who, whose title, who's this or that. It's crazy. You're just the one that's reminding me that I actually called that match. Like, that is crazy for me to know that. I'd love to hear that back. I don't even know. I'm sure I can find it on the network.
You can find it. And it's actually a really funny moment because I watched it and you hesitate for a moment. You say the winner of the match, Triple H. And I was like, oh, that's really funny. Now knowing it was her first night, like knowing how you call a match now, how you would announce a ring announcer now is so flawless and seamless. Like, it actually did stick out a little bit.
Dude, the whole thing stuck out for weeks. I was not trained. That's what people don't understand is when I showed up there, Michael Cole's giving me the tour and all, and I'm like, okay, it's my first day, but I don't know what I'm doing. I'm thinking I'm just getting an orientation. To then be told at 3:30 that afternoon, you're replacing Howard Finkel, you're going to ring announce. And I'm like,
and what shoes to fill, right? Like, oh yeah. My God, now knowing the Fink, like, I mean, the legend that he was.
Wow. Yeah. Props to him, though. He helped me. Tony Chimmel, both of them could have been so bitter and could have been like, nope, not going to help her. She can figure it out for herself. But instead, any questions you have, anything, just come, you know. And Howard himself, like, God, what a true soul. Cause he's the one that I really replaced, you know. Chimmel still did SmackDown. So, for him to help me as much as he did, it just is a testament to the man that he was and will always be.
Absolutely. A legend. He'll never be forgotten among, you know, the WWE universe.
Yeah.
So you appeared in your first on-screen angle very quickly, September 13th, Jeff Jarrett threw you in a figure four leg lock.
Yeah.
What was that like when you find out, like, all right, you're being thrown into not only one of the hottest times the WWF has ever had, right? The late 90s. Oh my God, you're into that madhouse, but now you're part of the show.
Yeah. Okay. So I think my acting that I've had in my past was like, yes, I get to be in a script. This is cool. Like, I loved it. I loved it. And they were telling me, like, when he puts you in that figure four, just make sure that you act like you're in so much pain. Because I got to tell you, Jeff took care of me. Like, I wasn't hurting. But if you look at the tape, you think I'm dying. And they were so happy when they saw it. They were like, you did so good. I was like, oh my God, anytime, guys. Like, seriously, I had so much fun. Like, there were times that, yes, it did really hurt. Like, I remember Jamal putting me up. I forget the name of the move. I got to think about it. Well, he lifted me over his head and then dropped me. Samoan drop. So, my God, that one, the air went out. Like, I couldn't breathe. And I felt like a Mack truck hit me the next day. I mean, it was like, wow, you guys sign up for this. Like, you sign up for this, like, day after night, right? But I got to tell you, I mean, they really did take good care of me whenever I was in any of those angles. And even that moment with Jamal, I'm so glad it came off that way because it looks amazing. And I survived it just fine.
Yeah.
It was fun.
So here's something I've always wondered, just as a diehard wrestling fan I mean, literally as long as I could remember. You're sitting by the timekeeper during matches and constantly matches are spilling over to that area, right? There's matches where they're sending wrestlers through the barricade and it breaks down. How many times have you come like this close to being damaged by one of those guys?
Absolutely. Just so many times.
Danger, like, is that constantly? It's funny.
I think Sheamus, there's a great picture of me like this with Sheamus like all over me. And I think I posted that when I was like, just another day of the office.
Did people ever try to give you a heads up like, hey, we're going to be spilling over towards your area tonight? Or sometimes was it a total surprise?
Most of the times, total surprise. And I think they wanted to do that too, to get our natural reactions, or we don't move out of the way too soon or something like that. There were times though, when the barricade, like if the barricade's going to come right straight through, for safety reasons, they'd be like, look, it's coming. Just, you know, bolt out of the way, that kind of deal. So they, WWE would take care, you know, of myself and the other announcers. But most of the time I always would tell them, don't tell me anything. Like, I want to watch this as a fan. I don't even know the endings. Like, I was like, do not tell me the endings of the matches, please.
Wow.
I want to genuinely be like excited and to know and watch the match going, who's going to win? Who's going to win? So you'll see me at ringside like this. Like, I was just always so in awe. And I had the front of the front row. Dude, I had the best seat of the house.
I mean, the best seat in the house for some of the greatest moments ever. I wanted to get into
ever.
What are your favorite moments? What was the first moment that you experienced that kind of made you go like, whoa, what I'm a part of is special here?
Well, I think the very first day of the job, and it was not even that night that I was so terrified with all the millions of people and thousands in the stands and all. It was when I was being given the orientation. When they brought me into the bowl and I looked around and I saw the TV cameras and I heard, you know, this place is going to be, it's sold out. And I looked around, I was like, whoa, this is crazy, right? That was the moment that I knew. But I also knew at that moment, it was so weird. I was like, I have a feeling I'm going to be able to get to sing here somehow, some way. Little did I know how it was going to work out, but look what happened.
Yeah, I mean, you're among the ranks to sing at WrestleMania. Like, the names that you could list there are just iconic, and you've sang it. How many WrestleManias? 3, 4?
So I sang 3, but then I sang this year. They had me do it on the bump before WrestleMania. So is that technically 4? I think so, because they
three
wanted
and a half,
me to...
3.5? You know? I have no idea.
Yeah. All I know is I hold the record, and that's pretty badass.
I mean, that's pretty amazing. Just like, there it is. You hold the record.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
But what were your favorite moments, personally? You can name a couple that you were out there for, that you experienced ringside.
Well, definitely singing the national anthem. I mean, that was always very, very special. The fact that I could contribute to that and be that moment of starting the night, you know, with the national anthem, especially after 9/11.
The most iconic, one of the most iconic moments in, you know, WWF history. It was the first mass gathering of Americans after 9/11. People don't, you know, note that very often.
They don't. And it's funny because I sometimes I'll think back and I go, how did you get through that moment? And I really think that it was the fact that I'd been singing the national anthem before every single show leading up to that really, really did help me. But, you know, thinking back to also looking over and seeing all those superstars massively signed up, you know, lined up along the ramp. I remember Paul Heyman looking at me right before I went out and just being like, you got this. You can do this. Like, you got this. And this is, you're just the vehicle, right? Like, that's always said, is I'm the vehicle to get the song through me to try to unite the country. But I never made it. It wasn't about me. It wasn't about me. It was literally about a moment to like, hey, try to bring unity. And I think that that's exactly what it turned out to be.
Yeah,
and
beautiful moment.
Thank you. It's definitely one of those that sticks out. Definitely then fast forward to, you know, Iraq and Afghanistan, being able to sing the national anthem with all the troops around. I mean, that was insane.
Of course, yeah.
Especially as an Army brat.
I was going to say, as someone whose father, yeah.
Lieutenant Colonel, like, you know, I grew up in a military base. You know, that's all I would see was the troops doing, all their morning exercises and, you know, drills and all of that was always like, I would just look out the window and there they were. So for me, it was like being around family, being around the military. And so those are moments. WrestleMania was always amazing, being in the ring and just massive amount of fans. There's just an energy, right? There's an energy that you get from the fans, which is why we love the fans so much. It's why the product works so well when you've got the fans and the superstars. We saw the Performance Center. It kind of really opened up the eyes of people of, wow, the fans do offer a lot to this product. Yeah. And the superstars see that. They know that. You know, and they were like, God, we miss them. We miss the energy so much. Thank goodness now I feel like it's way better. But I think that the good thing is that the Performance Center allowed to have the transition where you could appreciate the Thunderdome. Yeah. I think that if it went straight from a live audience to the Thunderdome virtually, you wouldn't have appreciated it as much as coming to that Performance Center in the middle, you know, and they did their best, but
I would
having
agree.
That in the middle definitely made you appreciate then the virtual experience.
And even when they would put out, like even for NXT, when they'll put out just a few fans and mic them up really well, you see that, you know, provides a big improvement. So let's, before we get you out of here, go back to the podcast, Chasing Glory. Who are some superstars that you have not yet had on the podcast that are kind of white whales for you, like the dream guests? Long list.
Goes on. You know, I'm fascinated by these stories, and everyone has a unique story. And that's what's so great is I don't like to put like one superstar over the other, like this has been my favorite or not. Everyone's just poured their hearts out. I mean, you can't measure people's stories, you know, one over the other at all. There are some people that I would love to get on, just like everybody. But it's funny, away from even wrestlers, I've even told this to some of my friends, like, I would love to interview Pat Benatar. Like, for me personally, she's someone that affected me in how I sing and why I sing in that style. And the amount of, you know, times that I would just sing her songs over and over and over. I'd love to be there in the room to be able to get her Chase for Glory, her story. And so it's not only, like I said, it's a stack of superstars that I would love to do, but even people outside that have affected me.
Yeah, that Pat Benatar answer is a great one. So I would love to see that. Lillian, tell everyone where they could find Chasing Glory, where they could find you on social media, all that stuff.
Well, it's so exciting because now Chasing Glory is on the free version of the WWE Network, which is great. So you can access it for free. I fly to Orlando to get these interviews. So I'm one-on-one with the superstars and we do tests beforehand. Everything's safe. It's been fascinating already. We were number 8 when we debuted, which is very special. And so I want to thank the fans to make that happen. But yeah, you can see it on the WWE Network and the free version. You can also download it wherever you get your podcasts. So if you want to listen to it, including the Chasing Glory app. And you can follow the show at Chasing Glory on Instagram, at Lillian Garcia on Instagram and Twitter. And for everything, so it's all under one roof, just go to ChasingGlory.com.
There you have it. Lillian, thank you very much. This has been a great chat. Go follow Chasing Glory and check it out on the WWE Network.
Thank you so much. You've been awesome.